Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas. Loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to now.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
The best conversations I have with my colleagues are the ones that happen when no one is looking, when we're not 100% sure yet what to write.
Hopefully, having conversations like this can help you figure out your own point of view. That's kind of our job as Washington Post opinions columnists. I'm Charles Lane, Deputy Opinion Editor.
And I'm Amanda Ripley, a contributing columnist. We're going to bring you into these conversations on a new podcast called Impromptu.
Follow Impromptu now, wherever you listen.
Get in touch with technology with Tech Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey there, everyone, and welcome to Tech Stuff. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
And I'm Lauren Volkelbaum.
And today we wanted to talk a bit about nuclear fusion.
Fusion.
Which is great because originally I thought it was fusion cuisine, and I went and ate a lot of California cuisine, and it was delicious, but it wasn't very informative.
Yeah, that sounds tasty and not necessarily technological,
yeah,
per
and then,
se.
Yeah, then I thought it was fusion jazz. And so I listened to some of that.
More technological.
Not really my thing, though.
Less delicious.
Yeah. But no, we're talking nuclear fusion. And to kind of give you an idea of what nuclear fusion is, how we are trying to harness nuclear fusion as a source of energy production, really electricity production.
It's being touted as one of the technologies of the future that is going to give us unlimited energy.
And how far away is it? 20 to 30 to 50 years.
And every year, it seems like we're still
20 to 30 to 50 years.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, that's one of those things that scientists will often, wryly kind of joke about, that the technology is always 20 years away. And, you know, it's because the challenges that we need to overcome are quite impressive.
Pretty serious.
Doesn't mean we won't do it, because human beings are amazing. You know, we innovate and invent. But let's kind of, first of all, talk about the difference between fusion and fission. Fission is the kind of nuclear process that is used in our nuclear power plants today.
Right.
So if you are familiar with the nuclear power plants, things like, you know, they're the famous ones that have suffered catastrophic failures, like mm-hmm. Three Mile Island or Chernobyl.
Fukushima, yeah.
But these are the reactors where they split up larger atoms into smaller atoms, and as a result, a great deal of energy is given off, really in the form of heat, which is then harnessed to convert water into steam, which turns steam turbines, which are connected to electrical generators generating electricity.
Mm-hmm.
So really, it's just a very, very efficient way of heating up a lot of water really quickly mm-hmm. and making it do work.
Efficient, very radioactive steam generator.
Yeah, yeah. And that's one of the big issues with the fission power plants, obviously, is that it uses nuclear radioactive material, not just nuclear material, radioactive material,
right.
And that it doesn't – the radioactivity is still very much a factor, once that reaction is finished.
For thousands and thousands of years.
Right, yeah. You generally speaking, only about 3% of the uranium in a uranium rod is used up in a fission reactor before the waste has to be disposed of, because it will continue to heat up until it reaches a point that's too hot and the reactor itself can suffer a failure.
You have that meltdown, right?
Yeah. There are some approaches that are suggesting that we take another pass at that nuclear waste and use that in a second round by immersing it in a molten salt, the waste-annihilating molten salt reactor.
I just can't get over the annihilator part.
Yeah,
of
the
that.
Waste That's, annihilator. Uh-huh. So this reactor would, it's still a fission reactor, but it would immerse the radioactive material, the uranium, in a molten salt and use that to control the heat in a way that would allow you to use that material for longer, so you'd be able to get more use out of the same radioactive material and reduce the life of the actual radioactive elements.
At the final output, I think it would only be radioactive. It would only be reactive for another 300 years.
Yeah. So still well beyond our lifetimes right now, but not something that you would say, all right, generations and generations and generations are going to have to be aware of this.
You don't have to start, programming things that people, languages that don't exist yet are going to be able to understand.
Right, right. How do I create a pictograph that shows exactly, do not go in here.
Don't touch this thing. We messed it up really hard.
Right. In 10,000 years, English may not even be a thing anymore. So that's one of those possible solutions. But fusion is very different. Fission, all about splitting atoms apart. Fusion is about being buddy-buddy and bringing atoms together. And this is the kind of process that we see happening in stars, including the sun.
The sun being a star, yes.
Yes. Yes, well, I'm just making sure people know that. And despite what one of my favorite bands has said in a cover of a song, actually, the sun is not really a mass of incandescent gas, a gigantic nuclear furnace. But they did correct it in a later song and say it was a miasma of incandescent plasma. So they did go back and correct it. But they were actually quoting an old song from a science album for kids, mm-hmm. which was to explain the process of fusion and how the sun generates energy and light. And the way it happens is it takes these hydrogen atoms, and because the sun is so massive and dense, there's a huge amount of gravity there. Mm-hmm. And it's creating an enormous amount of pressure and heat. So the heat is stripping those hydrogen atoms of their electrons.
Creating ions.
Uh-huh. That creates ions. And in a pure hydrogen atom is just a proton and an electron. So that electron goes away. Now you've just got a proton there.
Sure.
And so you have these protons now that are zipping around at
moving
incredible
very
speeds.
Fast.
And being pressed together really tightly by the amazing force of gravity. And at the sun's core, where this is the strongest, these atoms are banging up against each other so fast and so close that one of the other fundamental forces in the universe overacts the electromagnetic force. Now, the four forces in the universe include gravity, which is the weakest, but is it is the most effective over huge distances.
Right.
You have electromagnetic force. And then you have the strong and weak nuclear forces. Now, the strong force is what holds nucleic particles together. It's like the glue that keeps a nucleus together.
Right.
Right? So if you were able to get two protons close enough to each other, the strong nuclear force would be strong enough to counteract the electromagnetic force.
That's naturally driving them apart, because
right.
protons both have a positive charge, and if you've ever taken two magnets and tried to stick the two positive ends together, it resists you. It doesn't want to do that thing.
Exactly.
But when you get them to within 1/1,000,000,000th of a millimeter of each other,
yeah.
then that will go away.
Yeah.
Or it will be overcome by
the strong nuclear force. Exactly, yeah. So you have to get them really, really close together. Now, at that point, when you have fused two hydrogen protons together, you have created a different element. Hydrogen has now become helium at a temperature of millions of degrees. Doom, doom. Yeah, we can't see.
We might both be giants fans.
I'll be seeing them in a week.
To come into Atlanta. By the time you guys hear this, I've already seen it. And the show was awesome, I guess. So anyway, the protons have fused together to form helium. But here's the interesting thing. In that process, the mass of that helium atom is slightly less than the combined masses of the two hydrogen atoms that fuse together to make the helium.
Why is that, Jonathan?
Some of that mass gets converted into energy.
Right.
Now, there's a little equation you may have heard of called E equals mc squared.
I think some guy named Einstein was talking about that. I don't know.
Listen here, Einstein. Yeah. Einstein came up with this idea. He came up with a theory, and turns out that it looks like it's true. Energy equals mass times the square, or the speed of light squared, rather. Not the square speed of light, but the speed of light squared. So speed of light is a big, 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 big number. Then you square it, and it's even bigger.
Much bigger.
And you multiply...
exponentially bigger.
Yeah, and multiply that times whatever the mass is, you get your energy output. And so, essentially what this equation tells us is that a tiny little bit of mass, once converted into energy, will be an enormous amount of energy.
Right.
Same thing...
And also that mass and energy never really go away.
No.
They are simply converted.
Exactly.
Back
we,
and forth.
We cannot create or destroy energy, but what we can do is convert energy to mass and mass to energy, at least in theory. Now, if we were to convert energy to mass, it would take an awful lot of energy to make just a little bit of mass, which is why I always go crazy when I read the Harry Potter books and people conjure stuff out of thin air, because I think, you just destroyed like three solar systems in order to do that.
Clearly pulling them from a parallel dimension or something like that.
Yeah, so there's just a bunch of people in a parallel dimension like, it's so cold.
There's a really huge room of requirement somewhere that's just...
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Now you're talking my language. So yeah, it a little bit of mass creates a lot of energy. So even though we're talking tiny atomic measurements here, where we have the helium atom, which has got a lower mass than the two combined hydrogen atoms, that still puts off quite a bit of energy. And the sun is doing this all the time with tons of hydrogen converting into helium every day.
Right.
All right. So massive amount of energy that's being emitted. I mean, and if it weren't being emitted, then there would be no life on this planet.
Right. And we know it works, you know, so we can observe this. This is as far as we can tell, real science.
Yes. So we know it works. We know we can do it. In fact, we have done it. We've reproduced it here on Earth. We'll get into that in a little bit. But the question was, if the sun does this, if that's how the sun does this, could we create energy here on Earth using a similar method, knowing that on Earth the conditions are very different
from
the core of the sun?
We don't have that gravity or that heat that is allowing the sun to overcome
the electromagnetic force. Yeah, the gravity is the really important part, because that gravity is what's allowing this nuclear fusion process to happen at a temperature that would actually be lower than we would need here on Earth, because we don't have that gravity. We don't have the ability to compress the atoms as tightly together as we would if we had the sun's gravity.
Right, right.
We have to overcome that with even more heat.
Yeah, the sun only needs about 15 million degrees Kelvin, only a measly.
15 million Kelvin.
Sorry. Yeah. my bad. I always do that.
I did it once, and one of our great listeners corrected me, and that's the only reason I because our listeners are awesome, and they let me know when I've done something silly like that.
Completely ridiculous.
It's the only reason I know. So thank you, listeners.
So, the sun only needs about 15 million Kelvin in order to do this. Here on Earth, it would be something like 100 million.
Yeah, so we're talking massive amounts of energy that we would need here on Earth to compensate for the fact that we don't have that gravity there to help us with this reaction. Now, in the sun, you're talking about the pure hydrogen encountering other pure hydrogen. So one proton, one electron, the electrons get stripped away, the protons get fused together. But on Earth, we've discovered that there's a better combination to go with that requires less energy than it would if we were to use pure hydrogen.
Right. It's relatively difficult to run into pure hydrogen here.
Yeah,
you would have to
essentially split the hydrogen off of something else. There's lots of hydrogen on Earth. We have no shortage of it. Yeah, it's just connected to lots of other stuff.
Yeah.
So the two types, the two isotopes of hydrogen. An isotope, by the way, means that you have more or fewer neutrons than whatever the atom typically has, but it's a different number of neutrons than the base version of that atom.
Right.
But it's same number of protons, same number of electrons. So an isotope is one isotope of hydrogen is deuterium, which is also known as heavy hydrogen, and it has one proton and one neutron. So typically you would not have a neutron with hydrogen. Deuterium does have a neutron. And then you have tritium, which is called also called heavy hydrogen. So it's extra heavy. He's not heavy. He's my tritium. And this is a proton that has two neutrons. So same, still the same element. It's just a different isotope. Now, deuterium, we've got a lot of that here on Earth.
Yeah, it can be extracted from seawater. It's not radioactive or anything.
Yeah, it's not dangerous. You can find deuterium in ocean water. You cannot find tritium very easily, mostly because it's not completely stable. It does tend to decay. And it has
a half-life of about 10 years, but yeah. you can get it from lithium.
Yeah, if you take lithium, the metal lithium, not the medication, the metal lithium, and you bombard it with neutrons, then one of the things you get out of that is tritium. So that is one way to get the tritium. And we found out that tritium and deuterium, if you try to fuse those two together, then you get helium and a neutron out of that reaction. And it requires less energy than other combinations do.
Right. These are the current forms of fusion that are possible on our planet, are deuterium, tritium.
Yeah. And we're going to talk about how, you know, generating a nuclear fusion reaction here on Earth, what kind of challenges we encounter and how we've worked around them in just a moment. But before we do, let's take a quick moment to thank our sponsor.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to now.
There's a lot happening these days, but I have just the thing to get you up to speed on what matters without taking too much of your time. The 7 from the Washington Post is a podcast that gives you the 7 most important and interesting stories, and we always try to save room for something fun. You get it all in about 7 minutes or less. I'm Hannah Jewell. I'll get you caught up with the 7 every weekday. So follow the 7 right now.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There is still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, let's get back to fusion. So we've got the deuterium in the seawater. We can bombard some lithium with some neutrons and get some tritium out of that. We're ready to introduce the deuterium to the tritium and make a date and have them fuse together in a single unit of helium and shoot off an extra neutron.
And a lot of energy.
What do we need to do? So we know that we're going to be using deuterium and tritium because that's the most efficient way that we've found so far to be able to do
these. It's the easiest for us to use. Deuterium would actually be more efficient, but it's more difficult to get started.
Ah, I see. So, right. So we might get more energy output with deuterium, but it would also require more energy to get the whole thing started.
Right. Which is kind of the entire problem of fusion.
Yeah. In fact,
general.
That's the biggest. All right. We'll just go ahead and say that. One of the biggest challenges we face with fusion is the fact that in order to make a fusion reaction here on Earth, you have to pour in a great deal of energy so that you can create the situation you need.
Right, you're replicating what goes on in a star. That's really a lot of temperature, a lot of pressure.
Yeah. So in order to do that without all that pressure here on Earth, we've got to pour in even more temperature.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the big challenge: is how do you create a reaction that's going to generate more energy through the output than it required to start it?
Right.
So if it requires more energy to go in than you get out, you have an energy sink. You're actually losing energy.
You're in the red, and that's not really useful.
No,
it's still pretty cool.
Yeah,
but
it just
it's not commercially viable.
I guess if you want to make helium, there are probably
easier
better
ways to get helium.
We are running out. Still, that's a lot of energy you're pouring into making some balloons float, or cooling the Large Hadron Collider, however you want to think about it.
All right, but so there's two main ways that we are experimenting with this on Earth, and one of those is called magnetic confinement.
Right. So magnetic confinement is what was used in the Joint European Torus, or JET, fusion reactor. And this was sort of a test reactor. It wasn't meant to be like an electrical generator.
Right. It wasn't a power plant. It was more science is cool than anything else.
But this is a good point to say that, ultimately, the way we would generate electricity with these is not that we have some magical, power
energy
cables.
Energy collectors
that just plug into the bolts and then it pulls. Yeah.
This is still a steam generator.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is really interesting to me because, this is steampunk. I mean.
Yeah, we're essentially harnessing the power of the sun.
Of the atom.
Uh-huh. Yes. The stars themselves to turn water into steam. It's still converting water to steam to turn steam
really
turbines.
Really well, really efficiently.
Yeah, really efficiently. And a lot of water, because you're talking about a lot of heat.
Yeah.
So, then that's the other thing, is that if you could have used the same amount of energy you used to start the reaction to heat up some water.
Right. And get a better effect.
And get a better effect, then obviously this makes no sense. I mean, that's the whole point, is that we have to find a way to do a fusion reaction where we're getting more energy than we're putting into it. Otherwise, just take the reactor out and just direct your energy to water directly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Take out the middleman. But magnetic confinement, you mentioned, it uses a really powerful magnetic field to hold the ionized gas in place. An ionized gas is plasma.
Plasma.
So plasma is a gas where you've got free roaming electrons. That is what the sun is. That's, all that heat has stripped away the electrons. You've poured energy in, you've pushed the electrons away, you've got these free flowing nuclei inside the plasma. And then the magnetic field starts to press all of these nuclei together until you are able to fuse them. And what you get are helium atoms and free neutrons. The neutrons fly off and they hit what they call blankets.
Blankets of lithium.
Yep. Blankets. Lithium is in the blanket as well. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that, because remember, if you bombard lithium with a neutron, you create tritium, which means that you can continually create part of the fuel source you need for this reaction.
For free while you're in the middle of the process. Yeah. It's pretty neat.
Yeah. And it's also giving off a lot of energy in the form of heat, which is then heating up the water to turn it into steam, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So that's magnetic confinement. And we use different things to heat up the plasma, like we might use microwaves or lasers.
Or electricity.
Electricity.
I think that accelerator-driven neutral particle beams are integral in the International Thermonuclear Experimental Reactor, or ITER, which is the one in France.
Yes.
It comes from France.
That one, yes, it does. That one is still being built.
And it's projected to be finished in 2020.
Yep.
And projected to be online by 2030, although whether or not that is a true fact or not is, you know, remains to be seen.
Yeah. Yeah. So if it stays on target, then we'll be able to say by 2030, you know, if this is actually a viable means of generating electricity for us.
Right.
By the way, the chamber has a special name.
How did we decide that this is
tokamak.
Pronounced tokamak?
Yeah, I keep thinking tokamak.
We've got tokamaks here in Atlanta. Yeah, so it keeps throwing me off.
Tokamak is a restaurant chain in Atlanta that has obviously tacos.
Yes,
but this is tokamak.
It's actually a Russian acronym for toroidal chamber with axial magnetic field, which basically means it's a donut. It's a magnetic donut.
Magnetic donut. Yeah, these
and granted, this is a, you know, the ITER version is a 100-foot tall, 23,000-ton million part donut.
Enormous magnetic donut. Yeah, and the reason for the donut shape is they've found that that is the most effective way of containing the plasma in this really tight field, so that you can have these fusion reactions take place. So we've got magnetic confinement. There's another method which received some attention early on, and there's still some labs, like there's some in the United States, that are still looking at this approach, and it may even turn out that this ends up generating more energy in the long run than the magnetic confinement, but we're still trying to figure that out. It's called inertial confinement.
Right, and this is using laser beams or ion beams to squeeze and heat that hydrogen plasma.
Yeah, in this case, really, they take a pellet of frozen hydrogen.
Mm-hmm.
So you have deuterium and tritium in an actual physical pellet. So you're talking super cold.
Yeah, yeah, and pea-sized. I mean, like little bitty thing.
Yeah, and you're using these lasers or ions to heat that pellet into a plasma almost instantaneously. I mean, you're bombarding it with an enormous amount of energy. And essentially what's happening is that, all right, if you've ever seen the magic trick where the magician walks up to the dining table with all the beautiful glassware and everything that's perched perfectly on the tablecloth, and then he grabs the tablecloth and gives it a quick jerk and everything stays there.
Peter Venkman failed to do in Ghostbusters.
Exactly, yes. Yeah. It's the same sort of idea here, in that you are heating it up so fast that because this is a compressed pellet, and the lasers are actually compressing it, or ions are compressing it even further as it's being heated up, before the electromagnetic force has the opportunity to push the atoms apart, the strong nuclear force fuses them together.
And so it kind of implodes.
Yeah. So you gotta do, I mean, it's happening super fast.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
fraction, like 1/1,000,000th of a second, I think is how fast this happens.
It's insane. There are other differences between the inertial confinement and magnetic confinement. With magnetic confinement, the goal is to find a way to have ongoing fusion reactions, so that you don't have to just generate electricity or generate heat in spurts, that you could actually have a maintained reaction that goes on for an extended amount of time to generate as much electricity as is needed. Whereas inertial confinement, you'd have to set up multiple targets.
Oh, right, because the way that one of them works at the National Ignition Facility of Lawrenceville Livermore Laboratory in the United States, in California, I believe, it uses 192 laser beams to focus on a single point in a test chamber. And this single point is where that little pea-sized bit of
hydrogen
is sitting. And so, you know, they're working on ways to focus the lasers better and
essentially have multiple pellets.
And also to have chambers, multiple chambers with multiple pellets that are going off in succession, so that you create a continuous, in quotation marks, in the air.
Yeah.
Reaction.
Yeah. So it's a challenging thing, and if they are able to crack it, it has the potential to create quite a bit of electricity.
Mm-hmm.
So much so that we could start to really take the load off of things like fossil fuel based power plants.
Right. They're talking about with inertial confinement, a 50 to 100 times more energy output than you would have to put in.
Yeah.
Whereas the numbers that I've seen for ITER anyway are more like 7 times.
Yeah. So, you know, either way, you're still getting a lot of energy out.
Oh, sure.
And we're not there yet. No one has created a fusion reactor here on Earth that has been efficient enough for it to be a meaningful way to create electricity. Because you would be losing energy on the deal. So if these work out, it's going to be fantastic. There are a lot of challenges here. I mean, you can imagine if we're talking about using these incredible amounts of heat, you have to be able to design a reactor that can withstand
that.
Handle
it. Sure.
Yeah. And that's tough. It's not an easy thing to do.
Yeah.
So that's a big challenge. And then, well, we've got other ones as well. And again, scientists will say, like, it's about 20 years away.
Right.
So hopefully they're right.
You know, right now, I think one of the challenges is almost a societal challenge because people hear fusion and they think fission.
And they think radioactive,
meltdown, yeah. And not in my backyard,
right.
And et cetera.
Whereas fusion is potentially anyway loads safer than a fission reactor. Your output is a neutron and helium. It's not a heavy radioactive material
right. That's
going to have a half-life of several thousand years. It's stuff that is harmless once you have harnessed it.
Mm-hmm.
So really the question would be, you know, as long as the reactor is well-made and solid, mm-hmm. you don't have to worry about this heat escaping or other kind of mechanical failure.
Well, like any other steam turbine generator, it's going to have an impact on the environment in that, you know, you're going to be taking in water and that's an impact, and it's going to be putting off steam, which is an impact. And
there are a lot of designs I've seen where they have built in a system where they condense the steam back down into the water so it becomes a closed loop.
Right.
So at least then you'd still probably have a loss. I mean, it's hard to create a perfectly closed loop.
Yeah.
But if you could, then you could just essentially use the same water over and over and over again, because, you know, the steam's just going to condense into water, and then the water will go back into steam once you heat it up.
Yeah. And again, you know, even if you do have a loss, you're not going to be having Blinky the Three-Eyed Fish in the river outside.
Right. So yeah, there's, you know, and who knows? Maybe that'll really generate enough helium for us. I mostly joke about that because I seriously doubt there's any useful way to harness a huge amount of helium from these reactions.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to now.
There's a lot happening these days. But I have just the thing to get you up to speed on what matters, without taking too much of your time. The 7 from the Washington Post is a podcast that gives you the 7 most important and interesting stories, and we always try to save room for something fun. You get it all in about 7 minutes or less. I'm Hannah Jewell. I'll get you caught up with the 7 every weekday. So follow the 7 right now.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There is still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI. And Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI and revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
But that brings us to an idea called cold fusion. And cold fusion, It is kind of what it sounds like. I mean, the idea is what it sounds like. And if
it's not actually cold. It's more room temperature.
Room
fusion,
temperature fusion.
Really. But that's a little bit less of a fun buzzword.
Right.
So.
Well, compared to a 100 million degree reaction, it's
comparatively
frigid fusion.
Sure. Yeah.
But no, cold fusion is the idea that you would be able to create these reactions, these fusion reactions, at essentially room temperature and still get energy off of them, which if it were true would be huge because that would mean that we wouldn't have to pour in so much energy to start the reaction.
Yeah,
we just have to set up the right situation and harness the energy that comes off of it and make free energy for everybody.
Mm-hmm, right, right. Proponents of it, I like to call it low energy nuclear reactions.
Yeah, it does. Because cold fusion definitely has a stigma against it now. And
the reason for that is
there were a pair of scientists, Pons and Fleischmann, who published a paper that was
This was in 1989.
Yeah, it became really famous, and it was that they were talking about a reaction that they observed that gave off more energy than it should have, based upon what they did.
Right. What happened was they put an electrode of palladium into a thermos of heavy water, of deuterium oxide, and charged it with an electrical current. And supposedly the palladium catalyzed fusion by allowing the deuterium atoms to snuggle up.
So, in other words, they were able to create a fusion reaction at a very low temperature, comparatively speaking.
Mm-hmm. And, at room temperature, yeah.
And that they observed an excess of energy being given off by this. So they were like, Eureka, we have found a way to create electricity, or really to create energy through this reaction. And then a few labs tried to replicate their results, and early results seemed to replicate it, at least in a couple of instances. But upon further study, it seemed like most of those successes were due to either mechanical error, like someone misread
the output,
something, or it was a poorly calibrated
sensor, or
yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Like there always seemed to be something wrong with the experiment that put whatever the results were within the margin of error. And if it's within the margin of error, you cannot really be sure that you've got an actual positive result,
right?
So Pons and Fleischmann continued to talk about their studies and continued to be proponents of this idea, but it increasingly became sort of
a joke, really.
A pathological science is what other scientists were calling it.
Sure.
Which essentially means joke in science talk. No, they were saying that there was no real proof of it working, that the results were not replicable, which is something that's important in science, as it turns out.
Yeah, we like that.
And that there doesn't seem to be any support, based upon our understanding of the universe, that cold fusion could actually be a thing.
Mm-hmm. And this wasn't the only time that it's been attempted. Back in 2005, UCLA researchers were working with pyroelectric crystals to create electric fields in water, normal old stuff. And in 2009, the U.S. Navy's Space and Naval Warfare Systems Department was trying some stuff.
Yeah, and it doesn't seem to have ever panned out. Now, there are conspiracy theorists who suggest that perhaps big energy companies are suppressing information about cold fusion and have compromised the scientific community as such, and therefore cold fusion could be a thing, but we don't know about it because people are actively working against us from learning about it. I would not go so far as to say that. I will say that there is enough of a stigma against cold fusion and low energy nuclear reactions within the literature world that most magazines scientific journals
won't even consider publishing.
Sure. Right? So they dismiss it out of hand. Now, that I think people can make a legitimate argument that that is probably short-sighted, they should at least consider them so that other scientists have the opportunity to observe to learn about the results, try and replicate it, and then that's how we can
at least make a consideration about it before, rather than dismissing it out of hand.
Right.
I think
dismissing it out of hand ends up just creating more fuel for the conspiracy theorists. Now, personally, I don't think there's anything to it.
Counter culture. I was lectured about the terminology
of conspiracy theorists.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry that the conspiracy theorists hate the term conspiracy theorist. I'm really sorry about that. So anyway,
we're going to have Ben and Matt in here on our,
bring them on. Ben's my arch nemesis. Everyone knows that. So, and if you didn't know that, now you do. I called him my arch nemesis the very first day I met him 6 years ago. So, and it has held true. We, by the way, share train rides together and chat all the way and talk about music.
Very,
and
very, very little actual arch nemesis.
He's about as lazy a hero as I am lazy a supervillain. So really nothing happens.
Really? Is that how it works out? He's the hero. You're the villain. I mean, you've got the bald goatee thing.
That's the problem, right? I mean, I have to be the villain by default by Star Trek rules. We go off on a tangent. So anyway, the science does not seem to hold up. Cold fusion. It just doesn't seem to, there doesn't seem to be any support there. Now, maybe there actually is a way of doing it. Maybe there is, and it's just that whatever results were found were due to something else, and it just hasn't been discovered in the other examples. And maybe it'll turn out that is the answer, which would be amazing. And I think everyone really wants that world to exist.
Oh, absolutely.
It would mean that our energy problems, we would be in an energy surplus mm-hmm. to the point where when you have energy surplus, so many things become possible.
Yeah, it's one of those things that, you know, that you kind of start seeing in something like Star Trek, where it's just this perfect utopian universe where a lot of people don't have to work anymore because we have free energy, so we have free transportation, so we have free food.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and so obviously this would be a pretty great world, and I think it's pretty cynical, maybe not completely unrealistic, to say that corporations would suppress such a world for their own gain. Because I actually think they would have more to gain in the utopia version of the world than in the current one, but I don't know. I'm not a CEO of a major corporation, so maybe I would think in a different way if I were.
I can see how changing the status quo could be a scary thing.
Yeah, and I'm too lazy to try. Again, supervillain, lazy. So, I'm interested to see how the fusion reactors like ITER turn out, over the next couple of decades. If anyone does make advances in the cold fusion field, that would be phenomenal. And, you know, while I am a skeptic, and I fully admit that I'm a skeptic, I'm also a person who, if you show me evidence that really supports the claim and it's replicable, then I'm going to say, like, okay, you're right. I mean, that's how science works. That's
right.
I am willing to say, like, okay, my skepticism was not well founded because here we have proof.
Right. But until then, yeah.
But until then, I'm a skeptic.
One of my favorite stories about that, there's a Scottish physicist named Douglas Morrison who would attend these cold fusion conferences every year and listen. And from what I understand, really genuinely listen to these people who had these brilliant ideas about how these things might work and how they were supposedly working in their own labs. And he would stand up and say, "Can you please make me a cup of tea?" And they would go, "Well, it can't produce that much heat yet." And he would go, "Oh."
Yeah, that's the other thing, is that if cold fusion, if these reactions are actually happening, if there really is something to it, the problem would be, can it be scaled up to something that's useful?
Right, exactly.
And if it can't be scaled up, then it may be that, all right, well, we've learned something interesting that we didn't know before, which is always valuable. But if it's not practical to use this in any way of generating electricity, it doesn't actually meet the problem that we're trying to solve.
Right.
So that's something else to keep in mind. Although, personally, I'm always like, knowledge for knowledge's sake, bring it on.
Pretty cool.
So anyway, that kind of wraps up this full discussion about fusion. If you guys have any suggestions for future articles, if you want to berate me for the use of the term conspiracy theorist, you can write me. That's fine. Our address is techstuff@discovery.com. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle there is techstuffhsw. Please let us know if you have anything you want us to talk about. We are loving the submissions. We're keeping track of them, and it's really helping us out when we plan out our episodes. So
absolutely.
Keep them coming.
Yeah.
And Lauren and I will talk to you again really soon.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like Eco-Eye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say free this week into your Xfinity voice remote.
Managing your diabetes just got easier. The powerful new Dexcom G7 lets you see your glucose numbers on your compatible watch and phone without finger sticks. And because Dexcom G7 is the most accurate CGM system, you can be confident in your food, exercise, and medication decisions. And all those decisions can lead to big results, like more time in range and lower A1C. Get started at Dexcom.com.
Dexcom data on file 2023. If your glucose alerts and readings from the G7 do not match symptoms or expectations, use a blood glucose meter to make diabetes treatment decisions. For a list of compatible devices, visit Dexcom.com/compatibility.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
With dozens of streaming services, box office films, and content to choose from, people are spending over 2.5 years of their lives searching for what to watch. But The Hollywood Reporter brings you THR Charts, one place for you, your family, and friends to find the most watched TV shows and movies every week. THR Charts is a guide to help you spend less time scrolling through platforms so that you can spend more time watching and binging the content everyone is talking about, all supported by data and trusted sources like Nielsen, Comscore, and Paired Analytics. Check out THR Charts on HollywoodReporter.com.